You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Devin Monroe, and along with Richard Cranwell, we represent the plaintiff below, Linda Richmond, who's the appellant before the court today. This case has a very straightforward issue. It arises from a personal injury context dismissed for statute of limitations, a unique procedural posture, which is what's under review today, because there were two cases, a 2011 action that ended with a non-suit, and in the 2012 case, which we're currently here appealing the dismissal of. Now, what makes the case unique and what the central issue is under the non-suit statutes, is the 2012 case against the same party as the 2011 case, to fit in the plain language of 8.01-380 and 229. The first case contained a misnomer that's been admitted by both parties. A misnomer of the last name of the driver, defendant. She was called in the caption of the first case's complaint, Catherine E. Cornett. Her real name was Catherine E. Kraft, later changed to Catherine E. Volk. The 2011 case just said Catherine E. Cornett. It's also admitted, stipulated, that there is no Catherine E. Cornett, who's the wrong person accidentally named. This is not, by any stretch, a misjoinder scenario.
Did Catherine E. Volk or her insurer have knowledge or notice of the original filing within the first two-year period?
The facts that we stipulated to, because we relied upon the insurance company, were no. She received notice just after the expiration of the two-year.
So if we were doing 8.016 analysis, there would be no relation back.
There's an esoteric question, and there's a split in the circuit courts, over whether the first sentence of 8.01-6 still applies to a pure misnomer scenario. And we would argue it does.
I see that, but assuming that we were to apply 8.016, the relation back requirement is notice within the original period, which we don't have.
If there's a change of parties.
Well, the question I'm trying to get to eventually is this. It seems to me, and tell me why I'm wrong, that what you're arguing with 8.01-229 essentially wipes out the application of 8.016 for purposes of statutory limitation periods relating back. Why is that wrong?
Perhaps the way I should say this, Justice Kelsey, is the non-suit statute is always an alternative procedure. It's a remedial procedure. There's no question that when just about anybody non-suits a case, they're doing it because there's a defect in the first case. Usually something they're scared of. Could be approaching trial, could be a missed deadline. Service is one that the court has validated at least three times. Even if the action's in some voidable scenario because of some problem, the fact that the plaintiff chooses, instead of going to the court's mercy and using its discretion to get a due diligence ruling, to use a non-suit to remedy a problem with the statute, or with a problem with a service, allows the plaintiff to do that. And so this is certainly a remedy here. Yes, sir.
But the 8.016 statute is very specific, and it's only on one legal issue, the relationship of the statute of limitation periods relating back in a misnomer context, whereas the non-suit statute is obviously quite general, doesn't address specifically anything to do with limitations. Well, wouldn't the specific govern the general?
No, Your Honor, because there are no implied exceptions or superior rules against the non-suit statute. And the court has said that in McManaver versus Plunk. The non-suit statute is an absolute right. The savings clause is an absolute right. They don't admit of any implied exceptions.
There's no doubt you got your non-suit. So there's no question that the non-suit was properly exercised and you got it. The question is whether the statute of limitation period was told properly. And what I'm it's a huge hurdle for me personally. How do we overlook a very specific statute, 8.01, tailored to the relation back context? And say, well, we're just not going to do that because a much broader statute, which doesn't even address this very issue, seems to get them off the hook.
Let me start with the specific. All right, since the court has identified that as a priority, I would cite the court to the Dean versus SF Pizza case we cite in our reply brief from the Missouri Court of Appeals. They addressed that exact argument precisely. And they said, we have a statute by which you're supposed to amend to correct a misnomer. The non-suit achieves the relation back the same way because of the savings clause. The non-suit statute, in essence,
you're talking about the circuit court holding?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
The circuit court decision you cited?
Missouri Court of Appeals. Okay. Dean versus SF Pizza. It's in our reply brief, page 9, I believe. So, Judge, the bigger issue is under the common law. The statute is told. The fact that a misnomer occurs, by definition and as a matter of law, has the right party before the court from the time of its commencement under the wrong name. That's a substantive determination. It's admitted here that that party was before the court under a misnomer. So if the right party is before the court from the time it's filed, it doesn't matter what name is used as long as the evidence is sufficient to show that the right party was before the court. That's what the court commanded us to do in Estate of James versus Payton, to look at the pleadings, the substance of the pleadings, not the caption, for the determination of who is before the court.
The concept of relating back under 8.016 concerns me. If there is a non-suit, then the new action stands independently of the prior non-suit action, as if it never occurred. So if we apply 8.016 to what is it relating back to, or what is it relating back to?
We're not applying it in 1-6 because it would have had to have been used.
But there is a strong argument that it should apply because it speaks to misnomers. But
that would be
how do the two relate?
Again, that would be implying an exception to the non-suit and savings statutes. But 801.6, by its terms, only applies to where there's a change of parties. Okay, there's not a change of parties here.
Does it only apply to the question Justice Kelsey asked? It says also it included the misnomer language when it was amended to almost indicate it doesn't just apply to a change of parties, because obviously a misnomer is not a change of parties.
I think that the way that those phrases work, and again, I don't think our argument depends in any way upon whether 8.01-6 applies, because the non-suit saving statutes are absolute. But there could be a case where you have the wrong party also by a misnomer. So you have to correct the actual party, change the party. So where it says whether to correct a misnomer or otherwise, that is the legislature saying, we don't care if the name is wrong if you have the wrong party. If you're changing the party, it's only fair to see if the right party had notice. In this case, the right party was from before the court from day one. But, Justice, now I would refer you again to Dean versus SFP. It's very specific as to why that's the case. If the first action is valid, it's necessarily told from its inception. As a matter of law, if there's subject matter jurisdiction, if the first action is valid when it commenced, and it would have to be, the fact that it approaches non-suit in a voidable condition, just as this court sees when it sees a case that wasn't properly served, and somebody's facing dismissal because it's voidable, it's defective, if it approaches non-suit and is non-suited before a judgment, making it void, it's valid from its inception, so it necessarily tolls the statute from its inception. And that's what happened here. But the plain language of the savings statute says it's tolled. We would have to disregard that and argue that there is an implied exception, which this court has said there is not. There never is. In the language of the non-suit and savings statutes, to make 8.01-6 somehow superior because it's one procedural alternative. Again, the non-suit is always a remedial alternative to some procedure, whether it be something in which the words relation back are used or not. And Dean versus SF Pizza, by the way, dealt with that relation back language as well. So the non-suit relates back.
And it is your position that once the suit is refiled, you just change the party's name to the correct name and move on with nothing else being done?
The only three cases we can locate that have dealt with an analogous non-suit statute or renewal statute, what they call it in Georgia, along with the refiling, have said exactly that. Yes, of course you can, as long as the right party was before the court the first time. And that's essentially admitted here, because admitting a misnomer is admitting the right party was before the court the first time. The fact that it's not corrected, it's a defect, an amendable defect, doesn't change the validity of the original action against the right party. So it necessarily tolls the statute.
Misnomer is always presupposing the right party by the wrong name.
Correct.
Doesn't that undermine your interpretation, 81016, which is whether to correct a misnomer or otherwise? And then they give four criteria for relation back. So obviously the legislature is talking about a misnomer context exactly like yours. They got the name wrong. You got the general right person. You didn't say Ford instead of General Motors, but you said General Motors LLC instead of General Motors Inc. or whatever. So it's a misnomer. But there is a very specialized test for that, and basically, unless I'm overreading what you're saying in your briefs and your argument, your point is none of that matters.
It doesn't.
Okay.
It doesn't, Judge Justice. The point is, however, that assuming it did, this court would have to look at the first part of that second sentence, 8.01-6, when facing a motion to change the party, and just pretend it didn't exist. All right, this is not a situation where the party would have been changed. So maybe there is a situation where you change one party to another. You have the wrong person before the court named John Doe, and I actually was intending to sue the owner of the car, something like that. But I put the wrong name because his name was John Doson. All right, then I have a misnomer and the wrong party. I have to change the party. That's not what happened. The undisputed evidence, by the way, is that Ms. Volk appeared, especially, did not wave or general appearance, we're not arguing that, but said, I'm Catherine Volk, I'm the driver, I'm the one, quote, I erroneously identified in the caption of the complaint as Catherine E. Cornett. And then defense counsel endorsed the non-suit order for that defendant. So
the
she
problem
was
is that's
the
after the two-year period, which 8.016 would say that's too little too late.
Justice Kelsey, I cannot see any way to look at 8.01-6 and say it trumps the non-suit statute without violating stare decisis. This court has been unequivocal in saying that the non-suit statute and the savings statute don't admit of implied exceptions. The fact that there is a procedural remedy for something, the fact that there is a specific procedure set up to correct a misnomer, to get service, okay, that's a test. Why would that not be exclusive? In other words, this court has ruled at least three times that even though the service statute says if you're going to prove that your failure to get service should result in this case not being dismissed, you have to come before the trial court and prove due diligence. But if this court has ruled three times, wait a second, the plaintiff has a remedial alternative in the non-suit statute, can correct service based on the new filing. That's what the non-suit and savings statutes are for. They're always a parachute. That's what they're for. So there's nothing in 8.1-6 that says it's exclusive, and the fact that it uses the words relation back can't imply, contrary to the common law, that the filing of a valid action when it was commenced against the right party doesn't still toll the statute of limitations. What it's set up to do is it's going to say if you're going to fix that in this first case, you have to use 8.01-6 to do it. I'll reserve a minute with the court's indulgence.
May it please the court, I am John Ewer of the Roanoke Bar representing the appellee, Catherine Volk. I believe from Justice Kelsey's and Justice Powell's questions that the court understands our position. We believe exactly that 8016 is a specific statute, and under long-established canons of construction and interpretation, specific statutes govern general statutes if there is a conflict. We don't actually believe there's a conflict here. The plaintiff, as Justice Kelsey indicated, was allowed to take her non-suit, and now she did something interesting when she refiled. She did not refile in the same style, which I believe, in addition to the statute of limitations problem, violates Rule 1:8, which requires that any amendment to a pleading be made only with leave of court.
Counsel, let's stop there, because what troubles me is actually related to what you just said. Plaintiff was allowed to take her non-suit, acknowledging that this is the same person today that filed the first suit. And you're not only acknowledging it now, but you're, bear with me, there's no question pending, but your partner acknowledged it repeatedly in the first suit. First of all, signing the non-suit order as counsel for the defendant. And even then, that doesn't trouble me nearly as much as the motion to quash service of process. Because the process wasn't quashed, the motion wasn't made based upon having a misjoinder. You know, I am not this person. The process was quashed based upon the affirmative allegation to the court that I am the person named, but it wasn't served in the proper manner. And in fact, when I think through it, in order to have standing to come into court to quash the process, necessarily your partner had to acknowledge that the right party, that Ms. Vogt, Ms. Cornett, whatever the name is, was in fact the party who now was aware of the process and was brought into the suit. So, first of all, two questions. Effectively, are you approbating and reprobating? And second of all, ultimately, are we putting form over substance? Have you ever disavowed that the very same person was named in the first suit and the second, was brought into the first suit and the second suit, although clearly within this norm?
We are not approbating and reprobating, and I think the answer to your Honor's second question is this case has not gotten to the point of disavowing because no answer has been filed. The first complaint named, we have the same plaintiff in both cases, of course. The first complaint named is the defendant, Catherine Cornett. There is no such person. The summons issued to serve that complaint unilaterally modified the name of the person to be served to Catherine Cornett, a.k.a. Catherine Kraft.
Okay, let me read from your partner's motion to quash. On February 28, 2011, the plaintiff commenced this action against Catherine E. Cornett, paren, quote, the named defendant, end quote, paren, and then signed it as counsel for the defendant. How can that be?
Your Honor, looking at Joint Appendix page 50, I believe it was signed counsel for Catherine E. Volk, formerly known as Catherine E. Kraft.
Okay, look at the non-suit order.
The non-suit
signed
order,
it as counsel for the defendant.
That was a form order, as we explained in our brief, and I think in retrospect, it would be better to strike through that. This court quite
so
recently...
So we're supposed to take significant notice of the fact that there was the name was changed, but we're supposed to take no notice of the fact that when you sign at counsel for the defendant, you can say, well, that's just a form order and that doesn't really matter?
Your Honor, in Wooten v. Bank of America, this court has recently ruled that endorsing an order seen is not a waiver of a position.
I'm not talking about seen. I'm talking about who the counsel was the counsel for, and it says you're the counsel for the defendant.
Well, we're the only, there are other documents, Your Honor, in the record that show we are counsel only for Mrs. Volt and Mrs. Kraft. And the issue really, Your Honor, and it was it's a perplexing issue, if you will, a complaint in one name, summons including a different name. And the summons is the document we have to respond to. It's not the complaint, it's the summons. The summons named our individual, and so we appeared in the name of this unilaterally changed person who is not named in the complaint, named only in the summons, to say, if you're trying to serve Ms. Volk, she doesn't live at this address. Motion to quash, limited appearance, no concession.
It wasn't a special appearance.
Well, it does not, I agree that it does not use that term, although counsel has, I believe it is a special appearance, a limited and special appearance solely for the purpose of
how
moving to quash service
process.
How did
you make the appearance? How did you have standing to make the appearance unless it was a misnomer?
It is a misnomer, Your Honor, but we had standing because Our Lady had been served with the summons, and that, we concluded, required an appearance to say, essentially, we're not the person named in the complaint, but we have been served with a summons that has this other material in it, and we are not that person. And to the extent that the court plans to go forward on the summons.
Do me a favor. The motion to quash is at page 47 of the joint appendix.
Yes, sir.
Please show me where in that document it says, we're not this person, but somehow we've been served with this. And I don't read it that way. If you just tell me which numbered paragraph says that, I will be satisfied.
It is in that book. I believe, Your Honor, in the language saying erroneously identified in the caption and in the summons with this expanded form, and then the rest of it has to do with service.
Where does it say that we've been mistakenly served with this thing that clearly is for somebody else? Where does it say that? Where was the court notified of that? Where was the plaintiff notified of that?
I believe the plaintiff, well, it does not include that exact language, Your Honor, and I agree. The issue here, though, is that if the plaintiff had proceeded on the complaint, look at it this way, and taken a judgment. Well, the plaintiff obviously realized there was a problem between the time the complaint was filed and the time service was issued, because complaint says Cornett, service says Cornett, a.k.a. Volk, unlike the complaint. But if the plaintiff had been elected, if the service had simply said Cornett, it was posted service at an address where there is no such person, if the plaintiff had taken a judgment on that complaint, I do not believe there's any way that judgment would have been enforceable against Catherine Volk.
Okay.
Her name is not.
There's not
a live action.
That may or may not be the case. I won't dispute that. But let's turn the coin.
Yes.
If in the first suit your partner had made the argument that you are making now, which is that this did not name our client, then the plaintiff may have sat down and said, you know, we might have an 8.016 problem if we non-suit, and what are our other options? But because of the representations that your firm represented Catherine Cornett, misnamed, in the suit.
I must disagree, Your Honor, that we ever represented, represented Catherine Cornett.
Okay.
Or that Ms. Volk was Catherine.
Show me on pages 47 through 49 of the joint appendix where that is made clear.
Your Honor, this as a limited appearance, that sort of defense
where does
is a matter of a general appearance. It does not say that.
Where
Your
does
Honor.
It say that?
It does not say that, Your Honor. It is clear, I believe it is clear from the nature of a special appearance that points out to the plaintiff the misnomer that the plaintiff had obviously already recognized, because the plaintiff had changed the name in the service, in the summons.
What does it say, special appearance?
It does not use that term, Your Honor, but I believe under its 801.277, an appearance limited to challenging service of process is permissible, and that is all we did.
Then why did your firm sign the dismissal order? Why did your firm not say, we can't sign this? We don't represent this person.
Well, the dismissal order does not say counsel for Catherine Cornett.
It says for defendant,
that is, in hindsight, we should have just struck through for defendant, counsel for Volk. And I will concede that. We conceded that on brief. But I do not believe that that waives the limited appearance, which is, there's the conundrum, Your Honor. Cornett Volk is not named as a defendant in the complaint. If we were to appear generally on behalf of Volk, we would have made her a defendant in the complaint.
May I ask you about this conundrum? Does Catherine E. Cornett exist as far as anyone in this room knows?
No, sir.
So how could you possibly represent a non-existing person?
Well, I would agree, Your Honor.
You make a motion to quash saying you've sued a non-existent person and you served it on me.
Yes, sir.
And that ain't right. And that's a special appearance.
Limited appearance. You have no valid service.
But you represented to the court, Joint Appendix, page 50, that you represented a non-existent person. Not you, your partner.
Your Honor, I must respectfully disagree. We appeared and we signed.
Counsel for the defendant, Catherine E. Cornett, who doesn't exist. So consequently, the only conclusion one can reach is that the person you represented was...
Your Honor, looking at page 50, counsel for Catherine E. Volk, formerly known as Catherine E. Kraft.
I'm looking at the non-suit order.
Yes, sir. And
how
that
it's
order
endorsed.
Was prepared by plaintiff's counsel.
Somebody else prepared it. Consequently, we're not responsible for how we signed it.
I do not believe we misled the court, Your Honor, and the opinion of the circuit court, I think, clearly shows that the court was not misled.
Certainly misled the plaintiff, the plaintiff seems to think so, which is why we're here.
Pardon, Your Honor. When the plaintiff issued that summons, the plaintiff knew they had made a mistake. Now, they compounded it by serving the person they were trying to serve at a Cornett address. But the plaintiff already knew they had made a mistake when they prepared the summons. We appeared in response to that summons, which named Mrs. Volk, and made the limited appearance that we could make without making a general appearance and in any way submitting her to the jurisdiction of the court. I'd be happy to try to, that is our position. We do not believe we misled anyone. I believe the Wooten case, or the Salter case, the Wooten versus Bank of America case says that by endorsing, we have not waived prior positions. That's consistent with 801-384 as well.
Counsel, may I ask
yes, ma'am.
A question about 8.016? Counsel for Ms. Richmond, in its interpretation of 8.016, argues that the wording changing the party then triggers the four paragraphs or sentences following. And so as I understand their argument, they're saying if we are not changing the party because we have a misnomer situation, then the issue with regard to whether notice was given within the two-year period doesn't apply or doesn't matter. What is your response to that?
That the statute actually, as amended in 1996 in response to the DAVCO opinion, which we discuss in the opinion, which may or may not have gotten statutory interpretation wrong, but nevertheless, in the next session of the General Assembly, that interpretation was changed by adding to the second sentence the words, whether to correct a misnomer or otherwise.
I believe that. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to cut you off. Go ahead.
No, thank you, pardon.
Were you finished?
Well, just that we believe that in strictly construing the term party, that the party was being changed. And that goes back to the point that a judgment against Catherine Cornett would not have been enforceable against Catherine Volk. She was not a party to that first suit.
You said that by changing...
By correcting this number, I beg your pardon, I was done. Okay. Correcting this number, the statute now says an amendment changing the party, whether by to correct a misnomer or otherwise. I believe that sentence means that correcting a misnomer or otherwise, adding a totally new party, changing it, adding
but to the extent that correcting a misnomer is not changing a party, how does the language which starts the whole statute off, an amendment changing the party? His argument is that the whether by misnomer or otherwise perhaps would envision I have the wrong party and I have called them by the wrong name.
I think it embraces both, Your Honor, but I believe under the current statutory language as of 1996, changing this, a misnomer is a species of changing the party and that the four conditions apply. I see that my time has expired.
May I ask a question?
Absolutely.
Thank you. You agree that this is a misnomer, and when they're in court standing in front of the judge, they can't really correct the misnomer to have it relate back because Ms. Kraft, now Mrs. Volk, didn't get notice within 2 years.
Correct.
So the only option they have really to them at that point is non-suit. How is that any different than someone who hasn't served within a year and hasn't exercised due diligence within that year? Their case is heading south, and they non-suit, and we've said before that that is a fresh start for the plaintiff who did not serve within a year. How is this not different from that?
Because it's a question of statute of limitations, and 801 directly addresses relation back for limitations purposes. Service does not affect statute of limitations, Your Honor. And we have a specific statute that the legislature has told us how relation back works. And if I may just add, I believe if the court were not to enforce 8016 and say that it applies in this circumstance, that calls into question 806.1 and 6.2, which have to do with amending to change claims, to do a variety of other things, and have their own relation back provisions.
But if the statute of limitations tolls the non-suit statute, why do you even need to go to 8.016?
Because the legislature has told us we must. In a very specific statute in this circumstance, to change a party, whether to correct a misnomer or otherwise. It tolls, and actually, Your Honor, I believe when the wrong party is named. Now, this court has not decided a case where the misnomer issue involved a natural person. All the cases involve fiduciary parties, the executor versus the estate, or corporate parties, trade names versus corporate names. And in those circumstances, it makes sense to speak about what we have the trade name or the doing business as name in front of us. That's the right party, even though it should be named with its formal corporate name. In terms of an individual, the name matters, I would suggest, much more than in the corporate trade name circumstance. Unless the individual is using an alias, and it's stipulated here that Mrs. Volk has never been known as Catherine Cormack. I think you've got to name a party, bring them into court and get a judgment against them. You have to name them correctly, unless they concede, which we do not believe we have done under these circumstances. Thank you for the extra time, Your Honor.
Rebuttal?
Your Honors, the fundamental divergence here is we are making a substance over form analysis as to who's the right party and who's before the court in the first action. The defense is making a form over substance analysis where the caption rules. This court's repeatedly said that's not the way it works. Justice Kelsey, I would just refer the court to that Missouri opinion, but also to the two Georgia Supreme Court and Court of Appeals opinions that we cited, because they deal with the same procedural scenario. They're all dealing with a situation where the first action contained an amendable defect. That means it's still a pending action against a party. Has to be a party. Can't be non-joinder. Has to be a party. And who that party is a substantive question.
Were these cases relation back cases involving language similar to 8.016?
I believe that Missouri was, Your Honor. I did not draft the Georgia statute.
Our language is amendment changing a party, comma, whether to correct a misnomer or otherwise, which the syntax would say a misnomer is a subset of correcting a party, and they want to make sure that if you're in that subset or some other subset, here are the rules.
And I'm out of time, but I'll answer the court's question with the indulgence of the Chief Justice. There's no question. Under the common law, when you have, first of all, 8.1-6 speaks of an amendment. You have to have a valid action to amend one. There has to be a pending action to amend one. All right, so there may be cases where it's not fair if you're substituting a new party for another, but they didn't have notice. And that, of course, was the intent of 8.0-6 immediately, certainly initially. Now, the amendment is a wrinkle that we're all struggling with. But the issue of whether to correct a misnomer or otherwise, the court is in essence assuming that what that reflects is a legislative intent to abrogate misnomer law and treat it identical with misjoinder law. And I just don't see how that can be read into that when there's a permissible exception like, I've got the wrong guy by the wrong name. And the court conducts a substantive inquiry and says, boy, you got it so wrong. You had not only the guy by the wrong name, you had the wrong party. You're changing the party. So the fact that you misnamed that wrong party, you're going to have to go through this long test. But again, I believe that the court's rulings on the absolutism of 8.01-380 and 229 would govern.
Thank you very much. Call the next case.